Welcome to the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by the Keystone Sports Network. Get the best Penn State sports news and analysis at KeystoneSportsNetwork.com or download the Keystone Sports app from your smartphone.
Hello and welcome to the Keystone Kickoff Show. I'm Jim Galante along with Chris Buchanani. Chris, how are we doing this week?
I'm doing great, Jim. We're into June now. We're less than 30 days away from actually being able to legitimately talk preseason preview stuff, right? Instead of this off-season nonsense.
Exactly. And we got beautiful weather in central Pennsylvania. All is good. And I'm going to ruin all that good feeling by bringing up the topic that it's not a fun topic to bring up, Chris, but it's in the news. We do have to cover it, or at least we should cover it. And that's the story about the doctor with the lawsuit for a wrongful termination and him claiming that James Franklin interfered with medical decisions. How about giving our listeners just the background of the story?
Well, as best as I can make out, I mean, you have a former Penn State orthopedist who this lawsuit's been going on for years, and he claims that he was terminated in part because he stood in between James Franklin and his desire to get injured players back out on the field more quickly, and that he was wrongfully terminated. And the punchline is that at the end of the day, Penn State and James Franklin were dismissed from the lawsuit. Now, on a technicality, because of a filing error by this guy's lawyers, and you may hear that and think, man, this guy's lawyers must be really incompetent. And maybe they are, but the good news for him is that they were going up against Penn State's attorneys. And as I said on Twitter, Jim, you know, a few weeks ago, I said that the NCAA is the Washington Generals of the American legal system. I think that title may actually belong to our dear alma mater. Penn State may actually be the Washington Generals of the court system. It was relayed to me that a very wealthy booster of Penn State, who our audience probably wouldn't know, but had joked to a friend, man, you know, sometimes I think I want to sue Penn State because I've never seen them win a court case, not once. So he ended up being awarded $5.5 million in this lawsuit.
Well, you know, Chris, you beat me to the punchline with that, because I was just going to say the same thing. I wish I could find a reason to sue them. Especially when they seem to hand out $1 million like Tic Tacs here.
Penn State lawyers versus anybody in a court case is a more lopsided matchup than Penn State versus Ohio State the last 9 years.
Ooh, that cuts multiple ways there, Chris. So what we have is this doctor claiming wrongful termination. He couldn't, because of his lawyer's mistake, Penn State University itself and James Franklin no longer being sued. It was the medical center, Penn State's medical center.
Penn State Health.
Right. And the, I guess, his supervisor, I guess the claim there is officially the supervisor is the one who let him go with the wrongful termination. But the case itself seemed to turn on James Franklin and his interaction with the medical staff. Let's start with this, Chris, with where you stand on it. Is this a, oh my God, look at that, James Franklin interfering, that's awful, that's terrible, that can't happen? Or is it, you know what, this is a college football coach. This is what they do, not just James Franklin. It's what everybody would do.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, my impression of following this case just off and on over the last few years, and of course, you know, I have a bias. I want to believe good things about my alma mater and the football program, and that's tough to overcome. But I was not overly impressed with this guy's credibility in my mind. Like, I've not heard this criticism come out certainly publicly anywhere else. And, you know, like, I live here and I talk to people, and I'm told things that for one reason or another, I'll keep to myself and not say on the air. And I have never, not once heard, and trust me, I've heard plenty of criticisms of James from various quarters, I've not ever heard anyone suggest that he is in any kind of an unethical way trying to rush players back from injury. Now, every football coach wants to, you know, play fast and loose with the dividing line between injured and hurt, right? But I don't get the sense that he's doing that, number one, in any way that really like strains moral or ethical guidelines. And as I've said with many things with James Franklin, I think he's probably more to the benign side than most of his peers at other big-time college football programs, if I had to guess. So no, me personally, am I worried about it? Do I think this is like a sign of something really bad going on inside the football program? I've not seen any compelling evidence of that. And one thing I've definitely learned over the years is just because somebody wins money in a civil trial doesn't mean there's any kind of criminal guilt involved.
And I'm one, it makes me wonder.
Especially when they win that money going up against attorneys who are working for Penn State.
As you said, that's like beating the Washington Generals. But so now you have this situation at Penn State that Penn State, again, is labeled as being a certain way, a football university. And if we went to any major university and had that same conversation, would the same thing be happening there? Coaches interfering with the medical staff, and I'm using interfering in air quotes.
I mean, again, going back to my point, my guess is if we're going to define interference as what it seems like, you know, we can concretely establish James Franklin was doing in terms of like constantly checking in on good players who were experiencing some kind of injury situation and trying to get them back on the field as quickly as possible. Like, you're damn right. That is as old as the hills with football coaches, medical staff, and players. I mean, there's no story here. Frankly, Jim, I am certain there have been other similar situations to this, both in that, you know, questions about trying to get injured guys back on the field as quickly as possible, and just like, you know, kind of way off to the periphery, civil trials type stuff touching into other big time football programs. And we never knew about it because it was too regional or localized, or we thought about it for 30 seconds and then we forgot about it. And so to me, that's the other point here. Like, everyone who is concerned that, oh man, this sullies the reputation of the program, like, you have forgotten that we now live in an age where collective memory lasts for about 25 seconds. Like, I've often said that Penn State had the misfortune of being on the wrong end of the last national news story anybody actually remembers. And then social media and, you know, technology and Trump and everything came along that completely obliterated our ability to fixate on anything for any prolonged period of time. So I don't think the lasting damage, such as it is from this, will amount to anything at all. I think it was negligible to begin with. And as soon as there's something new to fill the news cycle, which has probably happened 6 or 7 times by the time you, the listener, are consuming this hashtag content, it'll be virtually gone from the conversation. Now, I may be proven wrong about that, but I doubt it.
Well, I'm happy to hear that because I'm afraid that the lawsuits would be coming after me because of my handling of my softball team, Chris, where I had a couple guys who just seemed like they were always injured. And quite candidly, I wasn't buying it. They belonged out on the field, Chris. All right. So if you get a new story with me in it, you'll know what it's about. But I'm also curious now, you talked about the news cycle. I'm not sure this one ever really hit the news cycle.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
I read recently a national story that was pointing at James Franklin. I'm not sure if it was one of those hot seat ones, but it pointed at this lawsuit as a reason why he might not belong for Penn State. And quite candidly, both locally and nationally, the story's been mostly ignored, which does surprise me a bit because there's a certain sensationalism to it.
Yeah, but there's no smoking gun. You have to say this guy accused James Franklin of XYZ and ultimately won damages in a wrongful termination suit. Now, the jury could have concluded that he proved the wrongful termination without also agreeing that he proved the worst things he said about James Franklin. And, you know, we don't know the details of this. And again, the guy's been here for 10 years, right? And you know, during a time period when there was hyper scrutiny on the football program. And so if he was really stretching the limits or outside of bounds on this thing, I think we would have more than one disgruntled guy who stood to become a multimillionaire to substantiate it.
And, you know, Chris, and I want to talk to you about this, that this kind of led to another story within the story with Trace McSorley and his testimony and his cross-exam. But before we get to that, I did want to ask you about, what does this say, though, about the legal system? They call it a wrongful termination, and the guy is due over $5 million?
Well, that's a whole other can of worms you want to open in the last minute of the segment, James. Look, man, I will be the last one to tell you that, in my opinion, the Penn State administration routinely crosses every T and dots every I. I want to defend my alma mater while also being realistic about her shortcomings, right? So going back to my point about you can win the damages without proving the most inflammatory charges, I'll certainly allow for the possibility that there were flaws in the process by which this guy's employment was terminated, without then drawing the conclusion that, oh, every single charge over the course of trying to win millions of dollars from Penn State that he made was true. So maybe the finding is correct, but it also doesn't necessarily substantiate every nasty thing he said about James Franklin.
All right, Chris. When we get back for quarter number two, I want to ask you about Trace McSorley, his testimony. And speaking of can of worms, that's where things get even more interesting. We're going to talk about that when we come back right after this break.
Reputation is everything. Hi, I'm Matt Nobby, General Manager of Bobby Rahal Honda State College, and we're proud of the reputation we've built with our customers. We're not just here to sell you a new car. We support you through every mile of your Honda ownership with benefits like free state inspections and a complimentary loaner vehicle. We'll even wash and vacuum your car when it's in for service. Our reputation is car buying made simple and great service after the sale. Stop by our West College Avenue showroom today or go online at BobbyRahalHondaOfStateCollege.com.
It's quarter number two on the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by the Keystone Sports Network. Get the best Penn State sports news and analysis at KeystoneSportsNetwork.com or download the Keystone Sports app from your smartphone.
Hello and welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show. He's Chris Buchanani. I'm Jim Galante. Yes, we're having the fun conversation. We're talking about lawsuits. And this legal matter was, no, it's not the NCAA settlement. It's the doctor suing Penn State, saying that James Franklin was meddling. But Chris, as we alluded to, this opened up another can of worms with the testimony. Now, James Franklin, as you mentioned, he's here 10 years. He's had a lot of players come through. No matter how guilty he might be of doing the things he was accused of, you're going to be able to find players who are going to support him, okay?
Well, and let's also note that not a single player has made this accusation. Not one.
Right. This came from the doctors, although yeah,
it's a reality. You go through hundreds of guys. Some of them are going to be disgruntled. There were plenty of players who came through the Penn State football program over 40 years who had unflattering things to say about Joe Paterno. Okay. Every coach is going to butt heads with some of his college football players. And yet we've not heard this accusation, not once, Jim, not from one player. But anyway, let's get back to the truth.
But they did have one player testify that he was felt he was being pressured to come back, right?
Maybe.
Okay. Yeah. And they named it. It was Robert Windsor that they named as testifying. So, and as far as my reading goes, that was the only one. But maybe the more interesting testimony, well, they got Saquon Barkley and Trace.
And I'm sure that was true, by the way. Like I said, all of these guys get into the gray zone, and you're naive if you think that's not the case.
It is. And at the very least, you know, coaches, they, as you said, they want their best players back. But we had some testimony from Trace McSorley, and it got a little interesting on his cross-examination, Chris. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, okay. To me, this is the far more relevant story from a Penn State football perspective and what our fans should be thinking about our head coach, because we have a lot of, I hope, and what I believe to be generally competent people who are very well compensated across multiple layers of administration at Penn State University to oversee James Franklin and how he runs the football program. If he's really guilty of unethical behavior when it comes to injured players, that's their job to figure it out, and they have not. So I'm going to take them at their word that the lack of action means that there's less to these charges than the guy who just made $5.5 million trying to trump them up would have you believe. So, you know, kind of in an effort to like establish that James does not have a history of pushing star players to play when they're hurt, they called Saquon Barkley and Trace McSorley, probably the two biggest names since James Franklin has been here, to testify that they were not pressured to come back from injury. So the doctor's lawyer, I think in a very savvy move, was able to get some pieces of information that he wanted to establish that Trace McSorley, when he was giving his testimony, that he kind of put him into a corner and had to admit that, like, yeah, he'd actually lied for his coach in the past. So that allowed them to establish then for the jury, like, hey, you can't really believe what this guy's saying because we just showed you an example of this guy lied for his coach in the past. So they bring up this incident that happened a couple years ago, Jim, a minor thing that went, I think, probably below the radar for the vast majority of Penn State football fans. Maybe a larger percentage of this listening audience will know about it because they are a little more plugged in. But frankly, if you're listening to me talk about this and have no idea about any of this, God bless you. That means you have a much higher level of mental health than Jim or me or any of the other diehards in the audience. So a big shout out to all our fellow straight jacket wearers who are like, oh yeah, he's talking about the Lebrano alumni trustee thing. So when Anthony Lebrano, who is an elected Penn State alumni trustee, very outspoken, was running for re-election this last time, he was one of the invitees at Trace McSorley's wedding, came up to Trace at the wedding, asked Trace if he could have his endorsement for running for re-election and if he would be photographed wearing a re-elect Lebrano button. And so Trace agreed. Lebrano puts the picture out on Facebook. And then afterwards, McSorley comes out and says, oh, no, like I never agreed to that. Like I did not pledge to support Anthony Lebrano or give him permission to use that photo or to say that I endorsed him. And that wasn't true. If you were watching at the time and you had a functional brain, you knew that wasn't true. You knew what happened was like Lebrano corralled this guy at his wedding. And, you know, Trace McSorley is not paying attention to the intricacies of Byzantine board of trustees politics at Penn State, right? Your buddy who you invite your wedding asks, hey, can you endorse me for trustee? Like, yeah, yeah, great, sure, fine, whatever. And then afterwards, somebody who I assumed was Brandon Short, got to him and said, like, no, you can't endorse the Soprano guy. You got to clean this up. You got to take it back. And again, he's like, whatever, okay, fine. I'll just say that I never said that I endorsed him. No harm, no foul. I don't care about any of this, nor should anyone else, except it ends up coming up in this trial. And now Trace McSorley is under oath. So he's put in a position where, you know, he doesn't want to perjure himself. So he has to admit, like, yeah, I lied about that. I initially told him that he could have my endorsement. But it comes out. I'm now reading directly from PennLive.com, who covered the trial. Later, McSorley said he learned from Franklin that Lubrano was, quote, adverse to the head coach's interests. So when Lubrano posted the photo of McSorley wearing his campaign button, McSorley dispatched a social media post to Penn State Nation denying he gave the trustee permission to use the photo. So initially, when my co-host, Kevin Horn, drew attention to this, I just kind of laughed at it and thought it was funny. I was surprised, like, oh, yeah, well, there's a shocker. It actually wasn't Brandon Short when I thought it was. But then I started ruminating on this, Jim. And I started getting angrier and angrier because I thought about our head coach, James Franklin, who has all we hear all the time about college head coaches have never had more responsibilities on their plate with recruiting and strategy and hiring and fundraising and PR. And now you got to add in NIL and you have to worry about the transfer portal and recruiting other teams' players and other teams recruiting your players. I thought about our guy who makes $10 million a year taking time out of his day to directly intervene in Trace McSorley endorsing a candidate for alumni trustee. By the way, for the record, there are like 75 people on our board of trustees. Okay. It's not that many. I'm exaggerating, but there's a ton. And the importance of any single elected alumni trustee on that board is negligible. Okay. It's like, could not be less significant. I thought about James taking time to actually devote mind share and mental bandwidth to this. And then I thought about every single time Penn State has looked unprepared at the critical moment of a big game. And I thought, this is another example of this person's inability to parse what is actually meaningful and important and deserving of his attention and what is totally irrelevant minutia, which should be so far off his radar, it doesn't even register. You know, it smacks of him getting, you know, prickly about things that are written about him in the press or on social media. And I think his inability, Jim, to let go of these totally meaningless details speaks to a larger issue. And I think it's probably costing the program. Like, there is absolutely no reason, none, that James Franklin, in the position he is in, should be directly intervening in something as trivial as the election for a single seat on the board of trustees. James, just as a heads up, I understand it was maybe a fight, especially during the Barron Barber administration. But now that you have a president and AD who are way more supportive of you, you are getting everything you are asking for. And whether or not the board of trustees vote for it is unanimous or 38-1 instead of 39-0 is meaningless. And it's not deserving of your attention. It's probably not even deserving of the attention of your subordinates and hatchet men. But at the very least, like, have the presence of mind to understand that the Mafia Don doesn't actually carry out the hits himself. He gets somebody else to do it for him. So if you must obsess over something as stupid and trivial as Anthony Lebrano's candidacy for alumni trustee, at least go out and get somebody else to do your dirty work for it. Don't call Trace McSorley and put him in a position to maybe have to perjure himself down the line and directly pressure him to take his Facebook endorsement back of Anthony Lebrano. Like, it's just infuriating to me. Like, it's indicative of a major deficiency in the guy that we all ought to be worried about. Sorry, I talked a lot.
That's okay. Well, my question
is infuriating.
Well, first of all, I'm sure he didn't think or realize that Trace McSorley was going to end up in a court of law.
No, I get having it. To testify. I get it. Well, my point is, what do you do? Your time management, your mental bandwidth management. It is ludicrous behavior.
The real question, Chris, is then why did he do it? What prompted that?
I think it is like an obsessive insecurity and it just an inability mentally He lacks the capacity to prioritize these things and understand, like, hey, you know what? I'm James Franklin. Who gives a crap what Mike Poorman wrote about me on statecollege.com? Who gives a crap what one alumni trustee, who frankly, by the way, everybody else on the board of trustees hates, says about me in private meetings that violate the Sunshine Act? Like, who cares about that? In fact, if James was smart, if he was a 4D chess player, he'd understand that Anthony coming out and opposing things that I want will actually make practically everyone else on that board want to vote for it more. So I should keep him in there precisely because his advocacy against me makes all the other drones want to vote for me even more. But the bottom line is he shouldn't be thinking about any of this at all because it's beneath him. And it's troubling to me that he thought this, you know, he, in whatever mental process he was going through, decided this was something that it should be a priority for him, the head coach of Penn State football. Ridiculous.
And just to take it one step further, I think it's ridiculous to be concerned about one of your players, even if it was one of your star players, one of the most famous players from your era, endorsed anybody for the Board of Trustees, because it really just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. All right, Chris, that is it for our lawsuit talk. We're going to talk about things a little bit more relevant to what's going on the field. We'll do that next.
Reputation is everything. Hi, I'm Matt Nobby, General Manager of Bobby Rahal Honda State College, and we're proud of the reputation we've built with our customers. We're not just here to sell you a new car. We support you through every mile of your Honda ownership with benefits like free state inspections and a complimentary loaner vehicle. We'll even wash and vacuum your car when it's in for service. Our reputation is car buying made simple and great service after the sale. Stop by our West College Avenue showroom today or go online at BobbyRahalHondaOfStateCollege.com.
Let's get back to the action on the Keystone Kickoff Show. Brought to you by the Keystone Sports Network. Get the best Penn State sports news and analysis at KeystoneSportsNetwork.com or download the Keystone Sports app from your smartphone.
Hello and welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show. He's Chris. I'm Jim. Chris, I promised we'd get away from lawsuits. However, I guess I'm not quite getting back to on the field stuff just quite yet. And let me give you the genesis of this segment and how we got here. I try to read up on everything I can nationally on college football. Want to see what the rest of the world is thinking, not just with my blinders on from the Penn State world. And it led to me to an article talking about the Southeast Conference and how it could be rough for them come this the playoffs. Teams might get screwed out of being there when they belong, making the playoffs. So it got me to do a little bit of research. I know you're a research kind of guy, so you would probably appreciate it.
Jim, real quick, before we get into this, I do just want to say, for whatever complaints we might have about the possibility of the 12-team field like watering down the postseason, I do think it's a much easier and less consequential slash heavy conversation to have about who's maybe getting left out when you're talking about like the 10th or 11th spot in the playoffs, as opposed to what we saw last season with Florida State getting left out of a 4-team field. So yeah, I'm excited to have this conversation, but I do think if nothing else, we're going to see as we go through this, that even when there are tough decisions to make, they're not nearly as consequential. Yeah. And I think that's a good thing. I think that's going to end up being a feature of the expanded playoff field.
I do, too. I think it'll be helpful. What I'm also curious to see is just how the committee will handle it. Because as I've mentioned this before, Chris, with the 4-team playoff, I am just amazed that it took like a committee of 13 and then we meet week after week. Chris, here's how they did it. Very simple. Until Florida State, you're undefeated from Power Five Conference, you're in. You have two losses, you're out. The debate comes if you have multiple one-loss teams that would take you beyond four games. Here's how the decision's made. If one of the one-loss teams from the Southeast Conference, they're in. If they're not part of the debate, then the Big Ten one-loss team is in. Then you go after that. And if by some chance number 4 and 5 are in the same conference, very easy, you go with the bigger name school. That's it. I just gave you in 1 minute how the committee works for a 4-team playoff. Now, Chris, although I think the writer of the article about the Southeast Conference getting screwed was a bit misguided, I do think that there is going to be some interesting decisions, and some people on the committee, they're going to have to do something that they've never done before, Chris. They're going to have to put some thought into this. Okay. So let me give you where my research took me, which was to the Southeast Conference. And I picked out, 9 teams, 5, 6, 7, yes, 9 teams that were in somebody's preseason top 25 ranking.
Okay.
And I ranked them in order, just a real quick, from the top: Georgia, Texas, Alabama, Ole Miss, Missouri, Tennessee, LSU, Oklahoma, and Texas A&M. Decent list. I have no arguments with where they have anybody. And then I projected the Southeast Conference season because, yes, Chris, I do not have a life. And I did this by saying, okay, Georgia was the top ranked of all these. If they play any of these teams, they win. Texas is next. They would win against everyone except Georgia, and so on down the line.
Okay.
Here's what I interest.
So, be clear, that ranking list you just gave me, that actually just controlled in every head-to-head matchup. Whoever was ranked higher, that's who you awarded the win to.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I made a couple notes of a couple extra games, other games that are still losable. And I know upsets happen, Chris. This won't be the way it ends up.
Sure.
But it kind of gives you an idea. Now, remember also the Southeast Conference only plays 8 conference games.
Right.
So Georgia and Texas, who are at the top of this list, they don't play each other. Only one of them plays Alabama, the third team in this list, okay, which happens to be Georgia. In going through this exercise, here's what I found fascinating. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 teams had 2 losses or fewer. Now, we've had this debate talking Penn State specifically. Well, if they're 10-2, they're going to be in the playoffs, right? Not so fast, my friend. You could have 7 Southeast Conference schools with 2 or fewer losses. There would be holy hell to pay if any Southeast Conference team with 2 losses does not make the playoffs, Chris.
That's probably true. Although, to your point, I do think it then becomes an issue of what does the Big Ten look like? Because going back to Florida State getting let out, that was a shot across the bow to let everybody in and outside of college football know that there are 2 power conferences and they will be given top priority and everybody else is welcome to have some scraps from the table, right? So let's just forget the Big 12 and the ACC exist in your scenario, which again, right, upsets happen, probably not going to occur, but if everything goes chalk, it could, right? I mean, it's not crazy. What does the Big 10 look like?
I'm glad you asked that, Chris.
Put one right across the center of the plate for you, Jimmy.
That's the way. Just lob it up there, that slow pitch softball. I did the same thing for the Big Ten. And let me just give you the rankings that I had from the, and I'm sure some people would argue with this, but let's go with it. Ohio State, Oregon, Michigan, Penn State, Iowa, and Washington. Okay. Some might debate that Iowa ahead of Washington, but it actually might have been because of the schedule.
Do you have USC in there?
No.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
So going through this, remember, USC has a tough schedule. Remember, they're playing LSU and Notre Dame out of conference.
Yeah, right, right.
So that might have been a factor in this potential ranking. If we did the same thing, Ohio State ranked number one out of that group. They would beat all of them. Oregon would lose to Ohio State, and they do play each other. They would beat everyone else. I've got five teams with two or fewer losses. And in fact, only one of them has two losses, and the rest have one or zero losses. So four teams, well, one undefeated team, three teams with one loss, and one team with two losses. If we're keeping track, Chris, that is 12 teams between the two big conferences, 12 of them with two or fewer losses. We still need to get a conference champion from the Big 12, the ACC, the Group of Five, not to mention, what about Notre Dame sneaking in? So at the very least, three or four of these teams. Now, yes, there will be upsets, but that might just change how this works, Chris, where, you know, someone else will sneak in with only two losses and give one of these teams a third loss. So,
right, sure. So, all right, right out of the gate, let's think of a few things here. So we've got 12 spots, right? And taking the Big Ten and the SEC out of it completely, we know that three of those spots will be occupied by the Group of Five champion and then the Big 12 and the ACC champions, right?
Yes.
And there's no provision by which Notre Dame being ranked higher than the ACC champ keeps that team out. The winner of the ACC championship game is getting in. So if Notre Dame wants to get a playoff spot, it has to be an at-large spot. That's been one of the things that was an issue for them remaining independent. There was no way they could capture one of those automatic, quote-unquote, conference champion bids, even if they're ranked fifth and the ACC champ is like 12th or something like that. So really, we only have nine spots for all of these, you know, one or two loss SEC and Big Ten teams that you're talking about. So first of all, we know two of the spots are going to go to the Big Ten and SEC champions. And I guess if we're using your formula where your spot in the ranking determines your projected outcome of the game, that doesn't complicate things at all because there's no conference championship game upset. Georgia and Ohio State are going to take those two spots. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. So then since you said there were four other teams in the Big Ten that had one or two losses, Oregon is the other team in the conference championship game, and they become a two-loss team.
Correct.
So, so now you have non-conference championship game participants, Penn State and Iowa, which end the season with fewer losses than Oregon, who was ranked ahead of them all year.
Correct.
Okay. Then so two-loss conference championship game participant Oregon gets tossed in the bucket with all the two-loss SEC teams. By the way, is there a one-loss team in the SEC title game, or do they go in with two losses?
No, I have Georgia and Texas going into it undefeated because they don't play each other.
Okay, all right, all right. So that's good.
And by the way, I also project Alabama with their one loss to Georgia complaining and screaming because Texas is in that championship game because they didn't have to play Georgia. That's my other projection.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. This is great. I love the potential for chaos we're already imagining here. And this is peak off-season nonsense content, Jim. I love it. This is great. Okay. All right. So then I know we're coming against the hard break on the segment here. So maybe where I want to go next is let's put Oregon out on an island for a moment and let's talk about who's left. We've now occupied five out of our 12 spots. Who's left? Who's got one loss?
Okay. We're going to do that when we come back because we have Alabama with one loss, Ole Miss, Missouri. And by the way, whoever loses that championship game, a corollary to the rule of Alabama complaining about not being in the championship game will be they think they should overtake whoever lost that conference championship game.
Sure.
Because let's remember, they're Alabama. So Alabama, Ole Miss, Missouri with one loss, and Penn State and Iowa with one loss in the Big Ten. We'll talk more about this, Chris, when we come back.
Reputation is everything. Hi, I'm Matt Nobby, General Manager of Bobby Rahal Honda State College, and we're proud of the reputation we've built with our customers. We're not just here to sell you a new car. We support you through every mile of your Honda ownership with benefits like free state inspections and a complimentary loaner vehicle. We'll even wash and vacuum your car when it's in for service. Our reputation is car buying made simple and great service after the sale. Stop by our West College Avenue showroom today or go online at BobbyRahalHondaOfStateCollege.com.
We head to the home stretch in quarter number four on the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by the Keystone Sports Network. Get the best Penn State sports news and analysis at KeystoneSportsNetwork.com or download the Keystone Sports app from your smartphone.
Hello and welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show. It's quarter number four. He's Chris. I'm Jim. We're going long range here. We're projecting what will happen in this upcoming season. We looked at both the Southeast Conference and the Big Ten and projected how that those conferences will finish up if everything goes to chalk. The favorite team wins all the games. We have Georgia, Texas, Alabama heading the way in the Southeast Conference, Ohio State, Oregon leading the way in the Big Ten. And I think, Chris, so far, the only conclusion we could come to thus far is Jim has too much time on his hands to go through this exercise. But setting that aside,
I call that commitment to the audience, Jim. It's not too much time on your hands.
Okay, let's do that. Let's call
Who's
it
doing this work for the listening audience?
I'm doing it for you, the listener. I hope you appreciate it. But in going through it, there are a couple conclusions that I made. First, let's get to your point, Chris, which is we'd then have Georgia and Texas playing in their conference championship game. Let's say Georgia wins. Ohio State beats Oregon for a second time. Oregon now gets thrown into the two-loss group. By the way, in this setup where it's Ohio State, Oregon, then Michigan in the rankings, Michigan has to play both Oregon and Ohio State. Penn State plays one of them. Iowa plays one of them. And that's it. Iowa doesn't have to play Penn State either. Iowa could be a one-loss team. And once more, Chris, they would be the worst one-loss team out there.
Oh, their schedule is ridiculous. And I think, you know, look, when push comes to shove, we've seen the committee will just nakedly say, like, sorry, your brand strength isn't strong enough. You're out. But just like Jordan Travis's injury gave them a nice escape hatch when they left Florida State out last year, I think that Iowa's strength of schedule, which is just a complete joke, would give them all the reason they needed if they had to exclude a one-loss Iowa team. But okay, so let's again, we're doing the math here. We got 12 playoff spots, five of them occupied by conference champions. Four get the first round bye, and then you just have the highest ranked group of five team. So how many one-loss teams do we have to fill up some of these remaining seven spots?
Well, we'd call Texas losing the championship game. Yep. So Texas, Alabama, Ole Miss, and Missouri in the Southeast Conference. That's okay. Four.
Yep.
Saying that Oregon gets their second loss, it would be Penn State and Iowa. So we're up to six. But what would be fun, Chris, is if Oregon beat Ohio State, we would have four one-loss teams coming out of the Big Ten and four one-loss teams coming out of the Southeast Conference.
Well, this is a nonsensical hypothetical. Let's not overcomplicate it any more than we already have, right? Okay, so we have now I think we're getting into where the rubber hits the road, where we can discuss how might the committee, or let's be honest, probably the executives at ESPN and Fox, break these ties to determine who are going to get the last few playoff spots. So I think for sure five of those six one-loss teams that you just projected in there, Jim, would get in. I think everybody down to Penn State gets a bid. No questions asked. You with me on that?
Yep.
Okay, so now we got two spots left, and we've got how many two-loss teams? I know we've got two-loss Oregon in the Big Ten, as we just discussed, taking their second L with two losses to Ohio State, one regular season, one the Big Ten championship game. Who we got coming out of the SEC? So two spots now.
Tennessee and LSU.
Okay.
And in the Big Ten, the two-loss team is Michigan. In that scenario, would you not argue that Oregon, with both their losses being to an undefeated Ohio State team and going to the conference championship game, they would be in?
Yeah, very hard to leave Oregon out. So let's just dispense with 11-1 Iowa. You guys are out. Forget about it. Like, complain about it. Sorry. I don't know. Cry. The good thing for your scenario from Penn State's perspective is if we're 11-1, which, again, would blow my mind. I've not seen James Franklin make it through a regular season without more than one loss since he's gotten here. So I don't think that's going to happen, but it could. You know, that would be something. By the way, it seems like I've been beating up on Franklin a lot on today's yes. show. I just try to be fair to the guy. I mean, overall, as longtime listeners or people who watch Obligatory know, like, you know, Kevin and I both will criticize him when we think he deserves it, and often he does. But whole picture, I'm still generally positive on the guy. So I just want to say that because I feel like I kind of beat him up pretty good today. But, yeah, so – very hard for me to imagine that with Penn State's schedule and brand strength, like that's differentiates them from Iowa very quickly. So, okay, let's put Oregon in there. They were in a conference championship game. It's wild to think you could go through their regular season slate and end up being punished so badly for making it to the conference championship game that you're left out of the playoffs entirely. Because if they were ranked, you know, like one notch below another good team in the Big Ten, then they would be 11-1 and a no-brainer to get in. So now we're talking about a three-way race for the final spot between two-loss Michigan and two-loss LSU and Tennessee, right?
Yes, yes.
So I wonder, Jim, does the ballyhooed difference between the Big Ten and SEC playing 9 versus 8 conference games start to come into consideration there? I think you also got to look at who those teams beat in their non-conference. I know that LSU is going to have that win over USC, but in our projections, USC is not that impressive of a win beyond the brand name.
Well, you know, Chris, and remember also, Michigan has a game versus Texas.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't calculate that game into my formula here, which actually now, as we go through this and drill all the way down, that game right there could get Michigan into the playoffs.
Yeah, but if we have Texas as one loss, then Michigan is actually a three-loss team, right?
Well, actually, I have – right. If Texas beats Michigan, Michigan has 3 losses, they're out of it.
Okay, so they're out. They're done. Now we're talking about LSU versus Tennessee.
Yes.
So I don't have it in front of me. Do you know Tennessee's non-conference schedule? I can pull it up here.
Well, they play Chattanooga.
Oh, look out.
NC State, Kent State, and UTEP.
Okay, so in that scenario, I think that, you know, both teams lost 2 conference games against higher-ranked opponents.
Correct.
So probably fair to assume, even if it was not by a lot, they were underdogs in both. So they were Correct. Supposed to lose those games, and they did. I think in the scenario we've cooked up here, it may be that you would see LSU rewarded for scheduling a Power 5 opponent, even if they turn out to be not that good, which USC definitely could. I think USC could surprise people this year. They also could be underwhelming because, you know, even what they've done, you know, bringing in the Penn State alum, Danton Lynn, across town from UCLA to be their defensive coordinator, they can't overhaul personnel. Over the course of one offseason. I suppose with the transfer portal, maybe you could, but they haven't. And so their defense is probably still going to be really bad. and the offense should be potent, but we saw what they did last year with a potent offense and a bad defense. And they could end up being a very middling, you know, 7-5 type team, but it's still not just a power five, it's a power two non-conference game, which I think in a tiebreaker scenario is going to look much more impressive for LSU. And even if USC is bad, even if they're below expectations, they're a better non-conference resume builder than any of those teams you just rattled off for Tennessee. I mean, their best opponent non-conference is NC State. And USC is going to win a battle of brand strength against NC State 100 times out of 100.
Well, here's the other part of this exercise, though, that struck me, Chris, is how within one conference, the strength of schedule can be so skewed. You know, typically we've seen in the Big Ten, hey, if you play in the eastern half, you've got, you know, Ohio State, Penn State, Michigan. And if you're out west, you don't. But like now that there's no split divisions and so many teams in a conference, I have Missouri with one loss, but I have them, you know, with their schedule, they play Alabama. Their only other potential losses are Oklahoma and Texas A&M. Okay. And I'm giving A&M enough credit to be, but listen to Oklahoma's schedule, who I think we all agree is a good team. But this is going to be the difference between playing in the Big 12 and playing in the Southeast Conference. And they obviously ticked off somebody in the schedule maker's office. They have to play Tennessee, Texas, Ole Miss, Missouri, Alabama, and LSU.
Yeah, it's brutal. I'm with you. I think Oklahoma's going to have a tough first year in the SEC.
But, you know, the other team coming in, Texas, yeah, they have Michigan non-conference. Give them credit for that. They play Georgia and they play Oklahoma like the rivalry game, but they don't really have nearly the number of tough games that Oklahoma does. So you have Iowa's the other example in the Big Ten. I have Washington losing three games to Michigan, to Oregon, and to Penn State.
I think they'll lose more than that, but yeah.
Well, but, you know, based right on the rankings, Iowa, we have them losing one game, and they just don't play the others. They don't play Penn State. They don't play Michigan. I don't think they don't play Washington. So you have this situation here where my conclusion is the committee is actually going to have to do some work here, Chris. And all of a sudden, by looking at these schedules, you might have, say, a one-loss Clemson and a two-loss Florida State, where you may have to look at Florida State's schedule and say, you know what? That's comparable or better than what Missouri had in the so-called much better conference. They're actually going to have to do some work, Chris. That's going to be the final word. Thank you all for listening. Make sure you join us next time on the Keystone Kickoff Show.
Reputation is everything. Hi, I'm Matt Nobby, General Manager of Bobby Rahal Honda State College, and we're proud of the reputation we've built with our customers. We're not just here to sell you a new car. We support you through every mile of your Honda ownership with benefits like free state inspections and a complimentary loaner vehicle. We'll even wash and vacuum your car when it's in for service. Our reputation is car buying made simple and great service after the sale. Stop by our West College Avenue showroom today or go online at BobbyRahalHondaOfStateCollege.com.